It's 4:06. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Cynthia Schuster in for Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, the world's population growth is booming or tapering off, depending on who you talk to. Our guest breaks down the world's population numbers and what they mean for the way we live.
First, Governor Scott Walker and Attorney General J.B. Van Hollen have asked a federal court to reinstate Wisconsin's voter ID law, though the court says a decision will not be made before oral arguments are heard on September 12th.
That's on the federal side. On the state court side, last month, Wisconsin's Supreme Court upheld the voter ID law, provided that the Department of Transportation could provide free IDs to people who don't have birth certificates.
Rick Essenberg is with us. He's president and general counsel of the Wisconsin Institute for Law and Liberty. Rick, welcome to Central Time.
Thanks for having me.
Governor Walker and Attorney General Van Hollen have asked the federal court to reinstate Wisconsin's voter ID law, but they haven't yet laid out how they will account for the free IDs they would have to provide to those without documentation like birth certificates. Given that, how likely is it that the federal court will reinstate the ID law?
You know, I have been doing this for 30 years and have come to realize that my ability to predict what courts will do is not what I'd like it to be. I think that ultimately, maybe not yet, but ultimately there's a fairly good chance that the voter ID law will be reinstated, or at least the case will be sent back down to Judge Adelman for additional consideration, because the state Supreme Court sort of substantially changed the assumptions upon which Judge Adelman's decision was based. I mean, it essentially told the Department of Motor Vehicles that they've got to give this free voter ID to anybody who comes in and signs a statement that says that, you know, they can't they don't have qualifying proof of identity and would have to, you know, pay a fee to get it. It seems to me that that has the potential to substantially change the analysis that led to the conclusion that the voter ID requirement violates Section 2 of the Voting Rights Act.
Well, is there a rush to get this law in place by November 4th? And do you hope that is the case, that they eventually get this reinstated by November 4th?
Well, the legislature passed a law in, I guess, early 2011. It's really unfortunate that the courts are still wrangling over whether that law is constitutional or not and can go into effect 3.5 years later. Generally, the presumption should be that if the legislature passes a law in our democratic form of government, that, you know, it ought to take effect unless it violates the Constitution. It seems at this point we know that the statute doesn't violate the state constitution. It seems unlikely to me, given the saving construction that the Wisconsin Supreme Court adopted, that it will ultimately be found to violate either the United States Constitution or the Voting Rights Act. So, yeah, the law should be put in place. Now, whether that can be done within the period of time that is, between now and the election, I guess, is another matter. Although, you know, people forget that the voter ID requirement was in effect for the primary, the February primary in 2011. And so it's not clear to me that implementing it is going to be as difficult or complicated as some people suggest.
And from a legal standpoint, why did the Supreme Court require that the DOT provide IDs to people who don't have suitable ones?
Well, the reasoning that the court engaged in was that the legislature passed a law and it said that you're entitled to free photo ID for purposes of voting. The way that this is being implemented is you go into the Department of Motor Vehicles to get this ID, and they would ask you for proof of identity, birth certificate, something like that. Now, for most people, that doesn't present a problem, but there are people who don't have birth certificates. It's a small number, but there are some people who don't have birth certificates or would have to pay a fee in order to get one. And the court thought that That raised constitutional concerns because it would be a little bit like imposing a poll tax, right? You can't vote unless you go and you spend $25 or whatever the fee is to get a birth certificate. And so what it did is it interpreted this requirement for to give a free identification to really require the Department of Motor Vehicles to give that free ID whenever somebody could say, look, I don't have a birth certificate. I don't have the underlying proof of identification, and I would have to pay a fee to get it.
Well, if this is a sticking point for the courts, why wasn't it part of the law in the first place?
Well, you'd have to ask the members of the legislature why it wasn't part of the law in the first place. My guess is that the answer you'd get is that they thought that that it wasn't a, you know, who knows? I mean, they may have thought that it was a bad idea because it would allow people to circumvent the requirement of photo ID. It would lessen sort of the anti-fraud potential of the law because you could just go in and maybe you aren't really who you say you are, but you say I can't prove it because I would have to get a fee. That may have been their reasoning, or they may not have thought it through. It's you know, speculation to say.
Well, and critics have said that voter ID will suppress voter turnout with little payoff in terms of preventing voter fraud. Do you believe there's anything to that?
There really is no evidence that voter ID suppresses turnout. There are studies that show that turnout has increased and has increased among minority voters after voter ID requirements have been implemented. Now, so on the suppression of turnout side, I think that that case hasn't been made. In fact, it seems to be wrong. On the other side of the question, how much fraud are you going to uncover with a voter ID requirement? I do believe that it's fair to say that one could not expect to deter thousands and thousands of fraudulent votes through a voter ID requirement, because if somebody was engaged in massive voter fraud, they probably wouldn't do it that way. They probably would target absentee ballots, although Wisconsin's law, unlike most, does apply in the absentee ballot context. But the problem is that we have elections that are sometimes very, very close, including elections on the local level. We filed an amicus brief in the state Supreme Court, and we listed a number of elections that were decided by a handful of votes. And it's in elections like that, that particularly in a state like Wisconsin, where you can register at the same time that you vote with sort of easily fabricated documentation, there's a case to be made that voter ID is sort of a reasonable form of regulation, particularly since it doesn't seem to suppress turnout. And with this construction of the law by the Wisconsin Supreme Court, it's hard to see why anybody would be unable to get a free identification.
Will all this back and forth in the courts with regards to voter ID here in Wisconsin continue to cause any confusion, or do you think that people are pretty much know what to expect on November 4th?
Well, you know, it so far it hasn't caused confusion. It's caused frustration on the part of, you know, people who support ID or who believe that the law has been passed by the legislature should be implemented. In February of 2011, when voter ID was in place and implemented, it went off without a hitch. Obviously, not having a photo ID requirement isn't going to cause any confusion because, you know, it just voters don't have to do anything in order to comply. And my guess is that if it goes into effect again, that we'll pretty much see what we saw in the 2011 election. The GAB, I think, did a pretty good job of you know, getting the word out and explaining to people what they had to do, and I'm confident that they can do it again.
The federal court ruled that the law violates the Voting Rights Act and the U.S. Constitution. What are the chances that this ruling will be overturned in the long run, whether for this election or not?
I think given the limiting construction that the Supreme Court put on the law, which I think that the odds are fairly high. As I said before, I it's hard to predict what courts will do, but I think the odds are fairly high that ultimately the law will be found to not violate the Voting Rights and not violate the United States Constitution.
Rick, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you.
We've been speaking with Rick Essenberg, President and General Counsel of the Wisconsin Institute for Law and Liberty, about the Governor and Attorney General's request that Wisconsin's voter ID law be reinstated by a federal court.
The world population currently stands at 7.2 billion. It's expected to rise to 9.6 billion by 2050, or will it? A slew of recent reports paint a kind of confusing picture of population trends.
While there are predictions of a huge population growth in parts of Africa and elsewhere, a Moody's report suggests the global population is aging due to a decline in birth rates, leading some to conclude that population growth may stagnate or even drop in the coming decades.
Robert Walker is with us now. Now he's president of the Population Institute. Robert, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much.
Well, first, in broad strokes, I think a lot of us have the sense that population is going up, keeps going up out into the future. We're seeing a few reports saying, hold on, birth rates, fertility rates are going down in a lot of developed countries. Developing countries are going to see the same trends. We're going to see the increase leveling off, maybe even going down. Where do you see this all coming together?
Well, fertility rates are certainly declining. They've been declining now for the past century. But we're still adding a billion people to the planet every 12 or 13 years. World population reached the 6 billion mark in October of 1999. We reached the 7 billion mark in October of 2011. And we anticipate that in about 10 more years, we'll be reaching the 8 billion mark. So world population today is still growing briskly, and according to the latest UN projections, what's called the medium variant, we anticipate that world population will likely reach about 9.6 billion, as you indicated earlier, by mid-century, and that we'll continue to grow and reach around 11 billion by the end of the century.
And there's a range of reactions to that kind of number. On one extreme, there's kind of the Thomas Malthus, where we'll have too many people, we're not going to be able to feed them, environmental devastation, all the way to, that's okay, the population's been growing, we've found ways, technology's improved, we can keep up with it, and we need it for a growing economy. What do you see as the impact of 9.6 billion people by 2050?
Well, let's be clear. The Earth can contain a lot of people, but it's never been a question about how many people the Earth can contain. It's always been about how many people the Earth can sustain, at what standard of living, and for how long. As you indicated earlier, currently the population is 7.2 billion. And even at today's population, there is plenty of evidence that we are overconsuming the world's resources and overusing the planet's biological capacity. Focus for just a moment on the fact that forests around the world are continuing to shrink. Tropical forests in particular are at risk. We see lakes and rivers in many parts of the world are shrinking. Even our own country, the mighty Colorado River, is a mere dribble by the time it gets to the ocean. We're seeing around the world in many areas that water tables are falling, and wells as a consequence are going dry. We see that in this country, in the Texas Panhandle, and the Central Valley today with the drought there. Keep in mind that we are changing the composition of the atmosphere. We're altering our climate and changing the chemistry of the oceans. And meanwhile, scientists warn that plant and animal species are going extinct at a rate that is about 1,000 times higher than the natural rate of extinction. Scientists are calling it the sixth mass extinction. So there's plenty of evidence to suggest that the world, in many ways, is already overpopulated, that we're already overusing the world's resources. So I think there's plenty of reason to be concerned.
Is this a question of too high a number, too many people, or is it a question of a certain part of that world population just consuming too much?
Well, there's no question that consumption is the other half of the equation. But no one is anticipating that per capita consumption in the world is going to start to decline anytime soon. We have a very large emerging middle class in the world today that's going to demand and has every right to demand its fair share of the world's resources. And as that happens, we're seeing an ever-growing claim on the world's resources. Unfortunately, the world resources are very limited. So we're quickly coming to a day of reckoning. We're going to see that day of reckoning in the area, certainly of water scarcity, but also in the area of food production. Right now, the latest estimates are that over the next 35 years, we're going to need to increase world food production somewhere between about 70 and 100%. And the question, and there's good questions to ask, is can we actually do that in the face of climate change, which includes both drought and flooding, but also rising temperatures and rising seas? But we also have a growing shortage of arable land in the world. And we know that the price of fertilizer, because of the increasing cost of fossil fuels, has gone up dramatically in the past decade. There's plenty of reasons to believe that agricultural production is going to be in real trouble in the next 35 years, even while the demand for food is growing at somewhere between 70 and 100%.
We've been talking globally so far. Let's key in on a couple of areas. The charts I've been looking at show massive growth in the years to come in Africa, sub-Saharan, the southern part of the continent in particular. What are we seeing there?
Well, we are seeing dramatic growth. With respect to Africa, currently its population is 1.1 billion, and we're expecting it to grow in the next 35 years to 2.4 billion. That's more than doubling its population. And population growth in sub-Saharan Africa is also very, very significant. Currently, it's 920 million people, and it's anticipated it will grow to 2.1 billion by 2050. And the reason why this is a concern is because when we talk about countries in sub-Saharan Africa, we're already talking about countries that are ranked very high in terms of severe poverty, very high in terms of hunger and food insecurity. And these are countries that in some cases, like Uganda, South Sudan, and Niger, where the population could triple within the next 40 years. And there's ample reason to believe that those countries simply are not capable of sustaining that kind of population increase. These are countries that are already devastated in many cases by famine and by hunger. And I don't think anyone realistically knows whether there's any chance at all that they can handle that type of projected population growth.
What would it take to not have that level of population growth?
Well, the good news, I think, is that as much as we know that world population is on a course to steadily increase over the remainder of this century, even small changes in fertility, birth rates, can have very substantial impacts on projected population growth. Now, in the cases of countries like Uganda, Niger, and South Sudan, we would have to see family size go down from a rate of five or six children to a rate of two or three children to really stabilize their populations in the long run. But we can do that. But the challenge here is different than the challenge that we faced half a century ago. Half a century ago, when we saw fertility rates dropping rapidly in many parts of the world, it was the fact that contraception was becoming widely available. Modern methods of contraception were dramatically reducing birth rates. What we see in sub-Saharan Africa and in parts of South Asia is a different situation today, because despite the increasing availability of contraception, fertility rates are not dropping very fast. Part of that is due to the fact that in many of these countries, child marriage is prevalent. And when a girl gets married at the age of 12 or 13 in a society that's heavily male-dominated, she's not going to have much decision over how many children she's going to have. And if she starts having children at the age of 12 or 13, she's likely to have five or six children over the course of her lifespan. So fertility rates are not falling as fast as we might have otherwise anticipated in sub-Saharan Africa and in other parts of the world, particularly in some parts of South Asia.
We're talking to Robert Walker with the Population Institute, looking at global population trends, what they mean for the quality of life in the future.
And we'd like to hear from you. Can you envision what life will be like with 2 billion more people living on the planet?
This is Central Time. I'm Rob Barrett.
And I'm Cynthia Schuster in for Veronica Rickard. We're talking about population growth and how it will affect life on Earth in the near future. And we'd like to hear from you. With 7 billion people on the planet now, what will it look like when we share it with 9 billion? What aspect of overpopulation worries you the most? Let us know at 1-800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or you can email us at talk@WPR.org. You can also tweet us at Central Time WPR.
Robert Walker stays with us. He's president of the Population Institute. He directs the Institute's work on issues related to health, economic development, sustainability, and the environment. Well, Robert, before the news, we talked about Africa, a big surge in population predicted there. Other countries are seeing declining birth rates. Places like Germany, Russia, Japan, Singapore, not hitting that replacement rate, that magic number to keep the population up. Some countries even offering incentives for their citizens to have kids. What do you make of that trend?
Well, there are countries in the world that you talked about that have reached the replacement rate and now face the prospect of declining populations. But essentially, that's a good thing. And the reason why I say it's a good thing is that the countries we're talking about consume a disproportionately high percentage of the world's resources. Let's take the United States, for example. We have less than 5% of the world's population, but we consume over 20% of the world's resources. So preventing unplanned pregnancies here in the United States and overseas in Western Europe and Japan and other countries that consume a disproportionate share of the world's resources, that's a good thing, because when you have a planet that is being stretched to its capacity, as it currently is, we have to be very mindful of the rate at which we are consuming resources. So with respect to policies that seek to increase population in these countries where population is stabilized, I think that's a bad thing. And it's a bad thing from a global perspective of resource scarcity.
We'll go to our callers now. We've got Victor on the line in West Dallas. Victor, hi.
Hi. Hey, two things I'd like to mention to you. One, when you have the, you would say, struggling countries that you mentioned, a lot of them, like, are going to Italy, they're coming to the United States, they're going to different parts of Europe. And number two is, I believe that the planet cannot support too many more people, because we won't be able to create a lot of jobs. And if you always hear on the radio that people are migrating to other countries because they're looking for a better life and looking for better monetary support.
Victor, thanks for the call. That point on migration first, Robert, is that one of the many consequences of the population growth in areas like Africa?
Certainly. As we see severe poverty still with a very significant grip on much of sub-Saharan Africa, and as resource shortages intensify, particularly as we see the climatic changes that are happening in Africa, we're going to see more and more people migrating to the north. And they will be in search of jobs. Right now, the world does not have a shortage of workers. It does have a shortage of jobs, and it's not just in the United States or in Western Europe. It's a global phenomenon. I think we have to be very mindful of the fact that this is going to have very severe implications for the world.
Well, looking at the history, as I understand it, generally living standards go up and fertility rates go down. Is that the case? And if so, how do you take a place with massive poverty and raise the living standards such that you hit that magic tipping point, whatever that is?
Well, I think you may have it backwards. What we've seen in many parts of the world today is when fertility rates have declined, economic well-being goes up. Economists and demographers have a word for it. They call it the demographic dividend, which suggests that as people begin to have smaller families, oftentimes because they now have access to modern methods of contraception, But as they have smaller families, they're better able to educate their children. They're better able to provide nutrition for those children that they have. They also have more resources to invest in boosting the family's income. And we've seen this happen all around the world. Back in the 1970s and the 1980s, we talked about the Asian tigers and what was happening in those Asian tigers of South Korea and Taiwan and Japan and the other countries in East Asia was that with their declining birth rates, they did have a demographic dividend, and they, as a result, had very substantial economic growth during that period. So really reducing fertility rates in sub-Saharan Africa and in parts of South Asia today is really crucial to boosting economic well-being in that section of the world.
Back to our callers now with Bob in Green Bay. Bob, hi.
Hey, good afternoon. How are you, gentlemen?
Good. What do you think, Bob?
I think this is a really cool topic, and this may be a little bit off subject, but it still has to go with population. And everybody talks about global warming, and we are, as human beings, we are organic things that live on this earth. And when things get overpopulated, nature has a way of taking care of itself.
Gotcha, Bob. So eventually nature is going to step in and intervene. It sounds like Bob is okay with that. Robert, I'm guessing you want humans to get in there before Mother Nature does.
That's right. We are facing, in many parts of the world today, a potential day of reckoning. And we can postpone or even prevent that day of reckoning if we do a couple different things. One is obviously to continue to expand the availability of modern methods of contraception. That's critically important. But in many of these countries today, we really need to educate girls, keep them in school, and empower women so that they have the ability to decide when they will have children and how many children they will have. And if we do that, we can live in better balance with nature. Going back to Bob's point, you know, there are many people who sort of like to paint this picture of human beings as being separate and distinct from nature, and that it's always a battle between man and the environment. Well, we are part of the environment, and when we do harm to the world's environment, when we change its climate, for example, we are ultimately doing harm to the human prospect. So it's really crucial that we get ahead of this problem.
From the policy level, are there things you'd like to see in United States foreign policy on population issues that you think would point the world in the right direction?
Well, yeah, I think there are two major things. One is, while we've seen in the Obama administration a significant increase in the level of support for international family planning assistance, we are still well below the levels of where we were 20 years ago, meaning that we should be doing more to help spread the availability of contraception in the developing world where it's really needed. But secondly, the United States needs to take a leading role in the fight for gender equality, particularly with respect to child marriage. Child marriage has been declared by the United Nations to be a violation of human rights, which it most certainly is. But we need all the world leading countries like the United States to really speak out vocally against child marriage. Because not only is it a violation of human rights, but it is also one of the principal reasons that many countries are being held back economically and socially. So, yes, there's much that the United States can do.
Maybe this is a crazy question, but what would the right number be? We're up over 7 billion people now. What do you think is the ballpark for a sustainable human population on this planet?
Well, as I indicated at the beginning of the program, I think there's ample evidence to believe that we're already overpopulated in the sense that we're over-consuming the world's resources. Now, there are some things that we can hope to achieve through conservation, through elimination of waste, and other factors to help us bring us back into balance. But fundamentally, we ultimately will have to see a not only stabilization of the human population, but we're going to have to see some contraction of the human population over the next couple centuries. And that's really critically important when you're already overutilizing the world's resources, which we are today.
Robert, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you very much for having me on the program.
That was Robert Walker. He's president of the Population Institute. It's time for Wisconsin Life with a different look at roads from a biker's perspective. A winding road makes for a motorcycle paradise. Ron Davis tells us about a legendary stretch of a highway near La Crosse.
Few avid motorcyclists haven't heard of the famous Tail of the Dragon near Deals Gap, North Carolina. Its 318 curves spread over just 11 miles have made the Dragon a legendary mecca for riders. But in Wisconsin, we have our own version, the Manduro Cut. Located near La Crosse, between West Salem and Manduro on Highway 108, the cut sits in the heart of Wisconsin's driftless area. The last glacier bypassed that part of the state, though its gushing runoff sculpted southwestern Wisconsin into a maze of towering ridges and deep, twisting valleys. Back in 1907, farmers around Phillips Ridge found it too steep to climb with crops for the railway in West Salem or milk for the Manduro Creamery, so they had to take the long way around. Under Governor Bob La Follette's Good Roads program, the state and area landowners paid workers $1.25 a day to chisel a cut through the ridge. To their dismay, contractors found they had underestimated the task. Rather than sandstone, as they had thought, they struck a hard dolomite dome 10 feet down. After 2 years, using only horse-drawn wagons, wheelbarrows, picks, shovels, and a little dynamite, workers had carved out what, at 74 feet deep and 28 feet wide, is the second deepest hand-hewn cut in the Western Hemisphere. It still ranks as the oldest cut that has remained unimproved, and in 2007 it was added to the National Register of Historic Places. But amazing as that might sound, it's not the Manduro Cut's history that attracts motorcyclists, sports car enthusiasts, or even bicyclists. It's the curves. Or to use rider jargon, the twisties. Starting on level ground and winding up and over at 1,300 feet, riders get a chance to thread their way through 20 or 30 snake-like bends and switchbacks. Though you can find plenty of pretty hairy videos online of riders pushing the limits of their skill, most riders enjoy the cut for the challenge of finding a smooth line through each bend, an elegant ballet of countersteering, lean, and throttle. The scenery is worth a leisurely look, too. Pausing at the turnout marked by a historical marker, you're bound to witness an intermittent parade that runs the gamut of two-wheelers. Older couples on gleaming BMWs talking excitedly into their helmet intercoms, grim-faced sport riders planning the apex of their next line, hopefully on the right side of the double yellow, grinning black leather bikers rumbling by on Harleys, or even squadrons of perky-colored scooters, their riders just having a blast. My recommendation? Whether you're a rider or what we call a cager on four wheels, check out the Manduro Cut. But take it easy on your first run. Enjoy the sights. Think finesse, not fast. This is no racetrack, and you never know who or what might be around the next corner. Hey, even the Tail of the Dragon has a 30-mile-an-hour speed limit, and you know you're going to want to turn around at the bottom and go right back through.
Ron Davis is a writer and teacher in central Wisconsin.
Wisconsin Life is produced by Erica Janik. It's a collaboration between Wisconsin Public Radio and Wisconsin Public Television in partnership with the Wisconsin Humanities Council.
For more information, visit the website wisconsinlife.org and find Wisconsin Life on Facebook.
Now another Wisconsin-based motorcyclist joins us to talk about motorcycle culture here in the state. Brandy Smith-Vuick has been riding for 20 years. She owns a lodge in the state that exclusively serves motorcyclists. Brandy, thanks for joining us.
Good morning, or good afternoon, Rob and Cynthia. How are you today?
Well, I'm really good. Well, I've got to ask, after hearing that piece, have you biked that Manduro Cut?
I have several times.
What's it like?
It's quite an interesting route to take, and anybody who visits this region, definitely it's a must-do ride. It's not a really long ride, but for many people, that's enough. A few twisties, a few little hairpin curves gets the blood rushing, gets your heart pounding, and you know maybe only 5 or 6 miles of that is enough. So for a lot of people, but it's a great ride. It's beautiful scenery. Many people who tour this area and have toured other areas of the country say it rivals the Tail of the Dragon, actually, that Ron mentioned. At least for that short stretch, it feels very much like that.
Talk a bit about motorcyclist culture here in the state and how much of a draw is your resort?
Well, because we cater exclusively to motorcyclists, we stay busy. I can say that, Cynthia. We stay busy. What we offer is unique because we offer lodging only for motorcyclists, people in cages or cars, while if they're towing a bike or they're supplying support for a group of motorcyclists, they unfortunately will have to find another place to stay because we are bikers only. But this area is a great draw for motorcyclists. The driftless region here is unique in the state, as you probably know, because of the glaciers having skirted this area. So it's nothing but twisties. It's nothing but valleys and ridges, and really, we tell people it is some of the finest riding in the Midwest and rivals some of the better riding outside of this area.
Well, Brandy, as a cager myself, I don't really know the motorcycle scene in the country. Are people coming from around the country to check us out here in Wisconsin?
Yes, people are. As a matter of fact, people are coming from other countries to check us out here in Wisconsin. We had a couple of folks from Germany stay with us last year. They were sport bike riders and came here to tour the region and to write. They wrote for a magazine that enjoys distribution in Europe for the most part, and they really loved the area, really loved it. And we've had people come from Cabo. They came through the region and adored it, and we get people from around the country, but you know, it's amazing to me that people from other countries want to visit here as well. It really is a gorgeous area to ride in.
How late in the season are you still getting visitors? Are people biking year-round?
Well, I know a few people that bike year-round. You have to really be a diehard, and I will say that most of them ride BMWs. If I am out in March and it's early and there isn't a leaf to be seen and it's 25 degrees and you see a bike coming at you, it's probably someone on a BMW. They are very devoted to their riding. However, once snow's on the ground, I think most motorcyclists give that up. So we stay open until the end of October. But for many folks, you know, once the leaves are off the trees and it's kind of dreary and bleary, they're ready to park the bike for the winter and just come out and pet it occasionally and think about spring and how wonderful it's going to be to get back on the roads once the sand and salt have washed away.
So I'm not terribly familiar with motorcycles, but why is it a BMW if you're seeing it in the winter?
Oh, you know, there's something about folks that ride BMWs, and not to be disrespectful to anybody else who rides any other model, it just seems like they are fearless in the face of the elements. Whether or not they're just unwilling to get off that bike, I don't know, but they break out all the heated gear and they are bundled up and they just don't seem to want to quit riding, I guess.
Now, Brandy, TV and movies, you know, Rebel Without a Cause to Sons of Anarchy, motorcycles associated with a bad element. In the real world, what's it like? What's the sense of community among the people who ride?
Well, there's a very strong sense of community amongst motorcyclists. And, you know, one thing that I always think of is, and it isn't just everyone likes to hang out in a bar and have some drinks and talk about the road, because certainly there's that too. And at our place, people like to hang out around the fire at night and talk about the road. But it goes beyond that. It goes beyond just just socializing. There are many groups that support great charitable causes. All you have to do is Google motorcycle runs or charity motorcycle runs in any state in the country, and you will see more than what you could possibly fill your weekends with. There's charitable rides for everyone who's maybe a local person who's been injured motorcycling or a family member, all the way up to the pediatric brain tumor. I can't think of the name of the organization, but they do a huge ride. There's rides for MS. There's rides for any illness or issue that you can think of, and that brings motorcyclists together, and people love that. And on a very basic level, if you're on a bike and you break down somewhere and you're alone, you aren't going to be alone for very long. If another motorcyclist comes by and sees that you're in need, they're going to stop. I'd like to think that that crosses all brands, that it has nothing to do with what brand of bike you're riding. You're a motorcyclist in trouble and you need some assistance, and someone is bound to stop and say, hey, what can I do for you? Can I make a call? Can I go get you a part? Is there something I can do for you?
Has biking culture in Wisconsin changed over time? What have you observed?
Well, I think that because of the influx of new riders that are coming in all the time, and then there's the opposite of that. It's an aging group of riders in some respects. Now, I'm speaking from what our clientele is, and our clientele is a little bit older, middle-agers for the most part, and they've seen a real cultural shift. It's everybody who rides now. It's not, 40 years ago it was bikers, and there was a certain persona associated with bikers. That really has changed. There is no one group or people that are bikers or motorcyclists. It's everybody who does it. So with that change, of course, then the culture changes too. Sure, people still like to go to bars and hang out and drink, and that's the classic, you know, thing that people think of. But, as I said, with all these charitable events and the people who motorcycle now, it really, really has changed the feel of motorcycling. Now, not completely. The reason people ride has not changed. The freedom of the road, the way it feels when you ride your motorcycle, there's nothing that you can compare that to.
Brandy, we'll leave it there. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Well, thank you so much for having me as a guest. I really...
That was Brandy Smith-Viewick, co-owner of Blue Highway Motorcycle Lodge, talking about motorcycle culture here in Wisconsin.